a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope. We planted the family tree. We got a hold of a pot full of gold bonanza. With a horse and a saddle, range full of cattle, how rich could a fella be? On this land we put our brand. Cartwright is the name. Fortune smiled the day we... Here in the West, we're living in the best... Wait a minute, hold it. With a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope, we... Hey, hold on a minute. This is... Look, these lyrics are 2 minutes and 10 seconds, and the music is 57 seconds. No wonder I can't make this match. I'm trying to stuff 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound sack.
It must be Tuesday. How could I tell? Talking television with Dave White, soon to be singing television with Dave White, is on the air. And with me, hopefully still here, is America's guru, Tim Carmody. Timmy.
I'm taking this stuff out of my ears.
Come on. You wouldn't. You know, that was by request. I made a big hit last week with singing the combat anthem. In fact, I got a ton of emails about that.
Now, the person that requested it, relative?
Oh, no. Listen, our guest tonight suggested that I sing the Bonanza theme. Susan McCrae, she's going to be on in about 20 minutes. And she's an expert on music, and she suggested to me that I sing the Bonanza theme. So that was a little warm-up, and obviously I had some problems with that. Speaking of problems, those of you that listened to last week's show knew we had one or two little problems. There's a couple you weren't even aware of, Tim.
A glitch or two.
A glitch or two we had. Those of you that listen know the phones didn't work last week. They're working tonight. So if you want to call the program, 800-407-KSAV. The email address, talk@ksav.org. Folks, this happened again last week. I found some responses in another email account the next day. The only account that I'll see during the program is talk@ksav.org. So if you want me to see them or you have comments or whatever for the guests, send them to that email address. Last week, Tim, the emails, even though I was receiving them, the senders were getting back error messages that they were undeliverable.
Hard to believe.
So the phones were down, the emails didn't work properly, and on Thursday I listened to the rebroadcast, and at halfway through, the power went off at the station and everything went down. In some ways, we never sounded better.
Could it be connected to your singing?
It might have. Actually, the station was not at fault. That was the local electric utility, the Fine Pacific Gas and Electric Company out here.
The ones that raised their rates recently?
Well, they had to cover the repair. So anyway, hopefully this week we are back. And that, you know, that program still, that was a fun show last week. And Joe Davidsmeyer, rolled with the punches as we all did. And the show came out really to be quite a bit of fun. I had a lot of emails on last week's show, especially on my singing. I'll tell you, I don't want to rush through them. I'm going to put those aside, and we'll probably do those next week. Those of you that send in comments, I got a lot of them put up on our listener feedback page. So if you want to go to the KSAV website, go to listener feedback, and you will see hopefully your remarks, and you'll also see the remarks of others as well. And they are fun. On a sad note, one of the things that there's just so many deaths in people associated with television, especially the older programs, the ones that you and I like so much, Tim, that I just don't have time to go through them all, but I do want to bring up one this week because it was really a television legend, Herb Strock. And Herb was on Talking Television twice with me. And he was not only a tremendously talented guy, but he was a nice guy. And they were fun programs, and he was a gracious guy. And took his time and shared so many of his experiences. Herb passed away on November the 30th, and I am working on getting some people together. We're going to do a little memorial show in Herb's honor, and I hope to set that up in January. So Herb was 87, so lived a long time, and I'll tell you, it's nice to we have a legacy like that for generations and future generations to enjoy. I had, well, you know, I better put this aside too, because we've got a couple of things. I had a listener request that we talk about the Magnificent Seven, which is being released on DVD this week, and I'm going to do that on Bill Grove's segment coming up. Before we do it, real quick, we got to get in a Brain Buster. Broadcast engineer, do we have the Brain Buster intro?
Talkin' Television presents Every week, we present a television trivia question of diabolical proportions. And now, with this week's Baffler, here's America's favorite guru, Tim Carmody.
Thank you. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay, the people in the front row are still looking like they're throwing something. Okay, those in the green room and those out there in Radio Land, here comes the one. This is about my favorite actor on TV, James Garner. Even popular and talented actors like James Garner can choose to be in a real dud. Here's the question. Name the show that Jim Garner had starred in that lasted only a month. It was a half-hour situation comedy. And I'll give you a hint. A single leftover hour-long episode was aired in December 6, 91. Remember, this show only lasted a month, and it was considered a real dud.
Okay, so it was September and October of 1991. We want the name of the program.
First one in with the answer.
Okay, and emails only to talk@ksav.org. Okay, I want to get Bill Groves and another special guest on. So while we bring them out of the green room, broadcast engineer, let's let the audience listen to cut number one, please. We are back. I said I was going to ask to fade the mute. I guess that was interpreted. On a new segment that we're starting this week is going to be something I've wanted to do for a while, and that is discuss new releases, new DVD releases, and offering to do the heavy lifting on that chore is Bill Groves, and Bill is a former editor of Television Chronicles magazine. He was a guest on our show. So, Bill, nice to have you back.
Well, it's good to be back.
Tell us what's new here in DVD world.
Well, let's see. This is aptly timed since your show's on Tuesday, and Tuesday's when the new releases tend to come out. So just running down the list of what hit the racks today, we've got season 4 of 24, you know, the popular current show with Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Bauer fighting terrorists and whatnot. Combat. Now, you recently had Joe Davidsmeyer on discussing that show. They've been releasing those in segments for a while, and now they're releasing the Battle Box. This is the big kahuna. This is the entire series in one collection. It's a little pricey, but I'm sure you can find...
Well, it was a little pricey to buy all the separate ones, too.
Well, that's true. And if you poke around on the Internet, you can probably find some good deals on that. Some other more contemporary series, Everybody Loves Raymond. That's season 5 is out on that. Full House, second season. Green Acres, going back a ways now to one of the classics. Season 3 of that is out today. Law and Order, season 4. MASH, season 9. Season 4 of MacGyver. I'm going, I guess, more or less alphabetically here down my list, aren't I? We've got season 2 of Murder, She Wrote. And Roseanne, season 2, we've got. There's a lot of stuff for kids out today, actually. A number of animated shows, Saturday morning or otherwise. There's Garfield and Friends, volume 5. Gargoyles, a more sort of superhero-ish show. And that's season 2, volume 1. Land of the Lost, the live-action Sid and Marty Krofft show from the 70s. There was a revival done in the 90s of that, but the one that is really the landmark, that's the one of the 70s. And the complete series of that is out today, so you can look for that. Also for kids, there's the Power Rangers SPD, Volume 4, titled Boom, and Volume 5, titled Zap. Let's see, we got Saved by the Bell, The New Class, which is Season 6 and 7. Star Wars Clone Wars. Now, obviously, Star Wars fans are not going to be just kids, so the really enthusiastic ones will probably want to add that to their collection. That's Volume 2 of Star Wars Clone Wars. And then there's new editions of Superman the Animated Series and Batman the Animated Series, which have sort of... There's a lot of excitement about Superman and Batman right now.
Okay. Listen, what's new in... I don't mean to rush you, Bill, but I want to discuss. What's new in Westerns?
Well, Westerns... Oh, and before I get to Westerns, also, since you've got it coming up, let me mention Rockford Files. Season 1 is coming out. Ed Robertson will be excited about that.
You know, now that you mentioned that, next week the featured program is going to be Rockford Files, and Ed is going to be on next week. I know you're a friend of his, Bill.
Right.
And Charles Floyd Johnson, who is producer of the Rockford Files, will also be a guest next week.
That sounds like a good show, and so season 1 is coming out, so everyone can rush out and buy it now, do your homework, and then you'll be ready for next week's show. You can call in and sound very authoritative. Now, as for Westerns, in fact, Magnificent Seven is coming out, season 1. Now, it's... I don't really know why they didn't do a complete series on that one, because when you combine seasons 1 and 2, you really have pretty much one full season. It was a mid-season entry, and then the second season didn't come along until mid-season. And in fact, the last 4 episodes did not even air originally. So those will be new to DVD buyers.
I had a request from a listener that wanted us to talk a bit about Magnificent Seven,
okay.
And that is why I asked Dan Galeoso of American Cowboy Magazine to join us for this discussion. Dan, you've been a guest also, so I welcome you back.
Well, it's good to be back, though.
To give us some you know, of your expertise, if you will, on Magnificent Seven, what you thought of it, when it was out, so on.
Well, it wasn't something I was particularly fond of, I think, because the original movie is such a great movie, the very first movie. I mean, it is the classic pulp guys Western movie. You know, it's not realistic, it's not historical, it doesn't matter. It's got more great lines in it than almost any other Western film. And that kind of formula, I'm fortunate enough to... A friend of mine wrote the pilot for Ken Desham and John Watson, a writer named Frank Dobbs. And he had even said, when he was working on it, I'd met him working on a miniseries called Rough Riders for TNT, and he said, well, I'm writing this thing for The Magnificent Seven as a TV series, and, you know, the problem is that, you know, half of the fun of The Magnificent Seven kind of, you know, arena is the gathering of the guys. That's the first third of the movie. How do you get the team together? Once you got the team together, that's your whole first act. And if you have it for a series, you don't have that anymore. You know, so you don't have the fun of gathering these guys and see what they're about and seeing how they size each other up against each other.
How did they intend to address the plot on an ongoing basis, if you will?
Oh, you know, I think it was just... They sell these things based upon name and content. And Penn Desham and John Watson were big feature film producers. They'd also written a lot, too. And they'd done Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Who starred in this?
Well, the biggest name would probably be either Ron Perlman the very, very tall actor, or Michael Biehn. And Michael Biehn's actually a real interesting actor. People, Western buffs will remember him from Tombstone. He played Johnny Ringo and did a great job playing Johnny Ringo. When you see him kind of sparring verbally with Val Kilmer, and he's twirling his gun, that's really him doing it. He used to be a juggler. And he actually got the gun coach, a guy named Thel Reed, to teach him how to do that so they could actually capture it on camera. So those are the two best-known names.
He also Robert had Dale Midkiff, who had had some success on TV with Time Tracks, or did Time Tracks come after?
Yeah. And
anyway, he's gotten some exposure.
Well, and you had Robert Vaughn occasionally doing a guest role. So
yeah,
that
which was pretty cool. One of the original Magnificent Seven.
Exactly. You know, kind of interesting. But it just seemed like kind of the wrong thing at the wrong time. It obviously has a nice little fan base. I think people were starved for, you know, some Western TV fare.
Yeah, this was on a lot more recently than I thought. What, this was on in the 90s, right?
98.
Yeah, 98 and 99.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there weren't, if you liked Westerns, there wasn't a lot of competition then, was there?
Oh, hardly any at all. I mean, you know, we'd had a little success almost 10 years before with Lonesome Dove, and I had worked on this miniseries that John Milius had done, Rough Riders, which was really kind of a Western, but kind of a military thing as well. And so, you know, you occasionally would have something that would pop up, maybe last a half a season, but not much. There really hadn't been too much out there, you know.
I thought Magnificent Seven was a fun show, but even aside from the story difficulties, it had an inherent production element that was just pretty much going to ensure its early demise, and that is you've got seven lead characters. And even starting off with, okay, three, Eric Close, a little bit known, but basically three names. If the show is at all successful, then everybody's going to be popular, and imagine what that's going to do next time salary negotiations.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, you bet. I mean, they could have found themselves, if it had been a successful show, it would have, you know, basically fed upon itself, because they would have either had to, you know, fire X number of, you know, the leads and cull it down to, you know, just a few characters, or just, you know, go way beyond in their budget.
Of course, they could kill off about three of them and be true to the source material, but, you know.
Well, and I think they had even flirted with, in the pilot, Frank, I think, had told me they'd flirted with killing off the Ron Perlman character, but then they liked him so much they decided to keep him.
We've got got winners, actually two answers in on the Brain Buster, so you've stumped them again.
For about 10 minutes, come on, give me credit.
I'm giving you credit. Hey, did Dan or Bill, did you hear me sing the Bonanza theme at the opening of the program tonight?
No, I'm afraid I missed that.
Oh, don't ask him to do it again.
Oh, I could
that's
do it
okay.
Live here.
Oh, that's all right.
Okay. Bill, did I kind of rushed into Magnificent Seven. Was there any other releases you wanted to alert people to?
Well, I think I made it through most of my list there.
Okay.
I think probably the only other significant one was season 5 of West Wing. But hey, I didn't hear the Brain Buster. I'm curious.
What the Brain Buster? Go ahead, Tim. Let's give them a chance to answer.
Okay, I'm sure that these two esteemed gentlemen will get it. It's a James Garner question, one of my favorite. We're talking about Westerns and Rockford, so I thought I'd combine the question. Name the show that even a popular and talented actor like Jim started, and it only lasted a month. It was a fairly recent one, and it was a half-hour situation comedy. It only lasted a month.
Oh, gosh. Was that presidential thing?
No, was it a family thing, wasn't it?
Oh, I love the way they're discussing
this.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I know he appeared on...
well, they've got to put him in the soundproof booth, I think.
Yeah, the
show, Dr. Joyce Brothers would have got it.
The show that John Ritter was on, and then passed away, that they carried on. They brought him in essentially as a replacement, as a grandfather.
No,
I'm sure that's not what you're referring to.
That actually lasted a little longer. This one was on a month. I'll give you a hint. In December 1991, they had this single leftover hour-long episode. They went ahead and aired that, even though the series had been long canceled for a few months anyway. So
all
1991.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's right. We've got a couple of...
go ahead. Tell them the answer.
We've got a couple... This is really embarrassing for you guys. I mean, to have the guru stump you with a question is one of the most embarrassing things here. The Man of the People.
Well, that's what I was
He was just going to say that.
Yeah.
He was just going to say
that. Well, I wasn't going to get the title.
you were very close.
I was thinking of some sort of political thing.
If you had seated, you have too much time on your hands.
Yeah.
All right, listen, we're going to bring on tonight's guest. And next week, I know, Bill, you're going to give your Christmas shopping recommendation list for DVDs.
Right.
All right, so be sure and tune in for that. And Dan Galeoso, thanks a lot for coming on. I know it was a lot of effort for you for a short time span. I appreciate you providing the expertise.
Oh, not a problem. And, you know, I have to quickly pay a compliment to Bill. You know, I have a book I'm just finishing up on the movies and TV shows of Custer's Last Stand, and TV Chronicles was very, very helpful.
Really?
In some of the stuff on Branded and some of the other series.
Oh, okay. Well,
very, very nice.
I'm glad I could be of service.
Well, thank you.
I thank both of you guys. And we're going to take a quick time out, and I've been taking some flack from the station on not having Christmas stuff on. Oh, this first one is a Christmas Coca-Cola commercial. But we got some interesting Christmas music coming up later on. It's not me singing either. So everybody stay tuned. Susan McCrae will be on with Tim and I when we return to talk television on Retro Radio.
There's just nothing like ice skating. It was wonderful fun way back in our grandparents' day, and it's still the favorite winter recreation, enjoyed by young and old everywhere. Now, time hasn't changed the fun of ice skating, nor the need to stop now and then, rest up, and refresh. And for fast refreshment, there's just nothing like a frosty bottle of Coca-Cola. So tangy in taste, so ever fresh in sparkle. Coke has a distinctive flavor that's never been equaled. And the way Coca-Cola brings you back so refreshed so quickly. For Coke offers a bit of wholesome energy. Gives you a bright little lift just when you need it. In any season, enjoy bracing, ice-cold Coca-Cola. Perfect refreshment anytime.
There are times every day as you work or you play when a pause would be welcome to you. And it's then that you find the bright spot in your mind that only a Coke will do.
50 million times a day, at home, at work, or on the way, there's nothing like a Coca-Cola, nothing like a Coke.
Yes, 50 million times a day, at home, at work, or on the way. Enjoy the pause that refreshes with ice-cold Coca-Cola, the most asked-for soft drink in the world.
There's nothing like a Coca-Cola, nothing like a Coke.
Time to get serious, talking television with Dave White, at least as serious as we can get. If you want to be on the program, 800-407-KSAV. The email address is talk@ksav.org. And incidentally, this was David was the winner on the Brain Buster, and we also had the correct answer from Block, but he was 4 minutes late. You know, what's the prize? I didn't announce the prize. In honor of me singing the Bonanza theme earlier tonight, I'm going to give away a DVD of Bonanza.
Oh.
And this is, the episodes are The Spanish Grant and The Gunman. And these are classic episodes.
Oh, you know, beautiful.
You know how I know that, Tim?
Because it says so in the cover.
It says so there on the label. That's right.
You didn't dub your song in there, did you?
On the line with us. But a pleasure to bring back on KSAV, because she was on the Perfectly Frank show earlier, Susan Sukman McCrae. Susan, welcome.
Well, thank you.
It's, you know, been a long time. We started planning this, and your appearance here about, a month and a half or whatever. Kent was on twice, and
yes.
So now your turn.
My turn.
We were talking off air. You had suggested this week when I talked to you that I should sing the Bonanza theme because I made my debut last week singing that combat theme song.
Yes, I heard you sing combat.
That's pretty darn good. Now, you're an expert on music, so you didn't get to hear the Bonanza theme.
No, I didn't.
And you wanted to know which version.
Lucky.
You wanted to know which...
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Forgot to introduce you. You wanted to know which version I sang.
Yes.
Okay, which one was it, Tim?
It was the off-key one. The words somewhere.
All right, well, that was the opening tonight, and due to time constraints, I don't have time to play that again. So you'll just have to go to the archive page.
Well, I will definitely do that.
Now, your career was as a casting director in television, but I want to give you a chance also to talk a bit about, because you had a career in music as well. You did some singing, I mean, professionally.
Yes.
Your father was an Academy Award-winning composer.
Yes.
You, among your other accomplishments, are a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences.
That's correct.
You serve as a judge on the nominating panel, is it?
Yes, I have done that, yes.
Okay, for Emmy Awards. Now, do you make the nominations, or are you part of the ones that choose who win the Emmys?
Well, no. There are usually panels for each category.
Okay.
And once the panel selects the five nominations, the nominees, then it goes to the entire Academy to vote for the winner.
Okay. But that would include you as a member of the
Academy.
That would
include me. Right?
Okay. Yes. About how many members are there?
I have no clue.
Okay. All right. I like these honest answers here, see, because you could have said anything, and
there's
I just said,
lot.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of people.
Okay.
It's a big industry.
Go ahead, and I want to give you a chance to talk a bit about your father, how you dedicated a foyer at the University of Hartford to him.
Yes.
Talk a bit about your book. And for those of you in the audience, don't get antsy. We're going to get into all the important programs, television programs and stuff. But Susan has a lot of achievements. I want to give her a chance to share a few of those with you.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
My father, as you said, was a composer and a concert pianist, and did some wonderful movies. He did the movie Song Without End. It was a story of Franz Liszt, for which he won his Oscar for. He did a movie called Fanny, which was originally on Broadway as a musical, and then it became a motion picture, starring Leslie Caron and Maurice Chevalier, and he was nominated for an Oscar for that. He did a movie called The Singing Nun with Debbie Reynolds, and he received another Oscar nomination for that. And he did a lot of television, starting with Dr. Kildare and The 11th Hour, and a lot of Westerns, including The High Chaparral, which I understand you have many fans of The High Chaparral who listen to your show.
As best I can tell, the most popular television program ever created and filmed based on my audience response was High Chaparral.
Well, it was a great show. It should have never left the air. It had something very special. It had a wonderful flavor of early America, and the Latin American people loved it. It was just a wonderful, wonderful show, and of course the music was spectacular.
Who composed that music?
Well, my father did all the scores for High Chaparral.
You know, that's right.
The theme itself was not written by him. The theme was written by David Rose.
That's who I was thinking of. You had, and I'll talk about this, you had put together a CD on your father called The Legacy of a Man and His Music.
Right.
And on here, there is, and I've listened to this, because being an important member of the television community like I am, I have a copy of this, and
And I'm a singer.
Stop now while you're ahead. The High Chaparral Suite, 15 minutes on here. Was that something, you know, where did that come from? Did you put that together?
Yes, actually, I did. Every character in the show of the High Chaparral had a theme. My father wrote a theme for each character so that whenever one would appear on screen or there was a storyline about that particular character, you always identified them with their music, and vice versa. And so I took those particular themes and had them arranged and put together as a suite, and I call it the High Chaparral Suite. And it's been performed in concert by many symphony orchestras around the country, and I think it's a wonderful piece.
Well, I would certainly agree. I've listened to the whole CD, and it is excellent. I was kind of arranging some notes here. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about your book.
Well, I just finished writing a children's book called Harry's Piano.
This would be a little above your level, Tim, but listen to it about it anyway.
Huh?
Oh, Tim.
I know.
That's so mean.
It's okay.
No,
it stands alone.
I'll tell you something. Tim, you'd love the pictures.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And
hey.
What?
Was that a shot?
No. Harry's Piano is basically the early life of my father when he started playing the piano at the age of five. And it goes all the way up until his first appearance as a concert pianist at the Hollywood Bowl here in Hollywood, California. And it's his early life. And I started doing this because, I, as you said before, I dedicated a foyer in Hartford, Connecticut, at the University of Hartford, which is a wonderful university, and we're very active. Kent and I are both regents there.
Is that the same thing that I referred to as a foyer?
Yes.
Early in the, yes, okay.
Yes, but that's all right. I will train you as I did the president of the university.
All right.
Yes, no, it's a wonderful school, and while I was working on that, there's a memorabilia exhibit and my father's Steinway Concert Grand in the foyer itself. And one of the principals, actually the principal of the Magnet School, which is located on the university campus, the University of Hartford Magnet School, which is a tremendous place, their principal, Cheryl Clocko, came over to me and said, you know, I'm reading all of this memorabilia and display, and you should really write a children's book, and that's what I sat down and I did.
Now, is this out? Has this been published?
This is being published as we speak. It will be released in January.
Okay, so there isn't a way for people to you know, get a hold of it yet, anyway.
Not yet, but they will be able to probably go on Amazon.com and several other ways of getting it. I assume they'll be in bookstores as well.
I understand. Here, I'll let you in. I shouldn't say you in because you know it, but I'll let the audience in on a little backstage stuff. KSAV is in negotiations with you to have your own program here, aren't they?
Well, yes.
Okay. So, and I bring that up in relation to the book because hopefully by then you're going to be on and doing a program.
Well, that would be a lot of fun for me. I think it would be very interesting.
Well, obviously, you know, I do too. So
I'd be a guest.
You could come on as the resident know-nothing or whatever, Tim. Yeah, or be a guest. You know, here's the guru from talking television.
I promise not to sing.
Dave, are you friends with Tim?
We were when this started, when the program started.
Just because I said somebody singing.
I had, you know, I'm going to take advantage here of your expertise in music because I've got some questions that that I want answered, and I always assume that if I don't know the answers mm-hmm. to these questions, obviously nobody knows them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
okay.
I may not know.
No, you're going to know. Now, what is the difference between, say, a composer of mm-hmm. music, a writer, and an arranger? Or what's arranging music? Define those things for me.
All right. Well, an arranger or orchestrator takes a composer's piece of music and arranges it, orchestrates it for each individual orchestra part, like the violin section and the brass section. That's a big difference between a composer who comes up with the music itself.
Oh, okay. I'm beginning to catch on now. So,
yeah, right.
Did your father do arranging, or was he just a composer?
My father was a composer, and he was an arranger
okay.
as well, but he never arranged for anyone else other than himself, or sometimes he did do special arrangements for instance, Frank Sinatra, who would ask him to do some piano arrangements that he would, when he would do some appearances, he would have his pianist play with him.
What is, then, this term scoring, mm-hmm. Scoring music or scoring a program or movie? What is that, then, specifically?
Scoring is writing the music, background music, for either a television program or a motion picture.
Okay, and now you said writing the music. Would that be composing it, then?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so then, if you score a program, you wouldn't be using a composer's music. You'd be doing it yourself.
That's right. You
okay.
are the composer and scoring a picture.
All right. There. Now, Tim, see, I asked the embarrassing question. You didn't know any of that, and I did that on behalf of you. No, that's right. I had heard
Thank
these
you.
Things thrown around and never had it clear in my mind, so I appreciate you explaining that.
There's
Absolutely.
A lot of room up there for new facts.
That's right.
We had, a few weeks ago, we had one of the brain busters when you were gone, Tim, was I put together a medley of theme songs and asked people to identify the programs they were from.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan not only identified the themes, but you named all of the composers of
yes.
those themes. And
yes.
you even knew several of them.
Yes, absolutely.
That's scary.
Yeah,
well,
yeah. On this show, it certainly is.
You know, my father knew every composer, I think. They used to come to the house. They used to play music together. My father would play the piano. They would come over and play some of their compositions. And so we, you know, it's a very small group of friends. And, I mean, I grew up with that. And it was wonderful. I mean, Harry Warren would walk into the living room or, you know, from 42nd Street. And Meredith Wilson would walk into the living room. All these people, Victor Young, who wrote some wonderful music, Stella by Starlight, Love Letters, When I Fall in Love.
We had, coming out of that first break, was the theme song from Mannix.
Mannix,
and,
yes.
That's right, and I chose that because Mannix was one of the programs that you worked on as
yes.
a casting director. We're going to get to those in a second. But that was the composer, I believe, was Lalo Schifrin.
Lalo
Schifrin. Well, he changed his name.
I always
knew him as Lalo.
Lalo wrote the theme for Mission Impossible.
And Mannix, wasn't
mm-hmm,
it?
That's yeah. correct.
Okay. Among others, I know what, at least I think I know, Hawaii 5-0, that was Nelson Riddle, wasn't it?
No, that was Morton Stevens.
Uh-oh, okay. All right. did you know them?
Yes.
Okay.
Lalo Schifrin was, matter of fact, a very good friend of my father's, and a wonderful man. And, yes, I knew him quite well. Morton Stevens, I didn't personally know, but, yes, definitely very familiar with my dad.
When Tim and I did a program on theme songs, on
mm-hmm.
television theme songs, and this is something that Tim, you've lamented many times, is studio orchestras, I guess we call them, no longer exist, do
they? That's correct.
And as a result of that, at least in my, let me ask you, what do you think about the loss of studio orchestras?
Well, it's kind of sad, really. But, you know, at least the composer can request certain musicians that he feels comfortable working with and who he thinks is the best musician for the particular movie or television show that he's doing. When my father began, he started at Paramount Studio on staff as the staff pianist. So it was a tremendous advantage for him because being a musician, you know, is not a very easy vocation. Anything in this business is not, but that particularly is
Well, I think the loss of studio orchestras has just put an end to what I'll call really memorable or great theme music. The stuff, I'm obviously not too familiar with current shows, but there aren't any. It's just all canned stuff, isn't it?
Well, there isn't. You know, there isn't a lot of wonderful scores on television shows anymore.
Now I know what a score is, see, so now I can...
Yes, exactly. No, it's really very sad. And if you do have a wonderful theme, you'll never hear it, because you're going to see either promos for the next show, or you're going to see credits rolling.
That is maddening when they shrink the titles at the end.
You can't even see the names anymore. You just see promos for upcoming shows. It's very unfair.
Tim and I had talked about on our program, we're going to go to a break and not going to come back, and we're going to talk about television casting. On that show, how certain themes, and Tim, we mentioned like Hawaii Five-O and some others. You were there at the beginning of that program. You didn't come in at 2 minutes after the hour, 3 minutes after the hour, because you wanted to hear that music.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's it certainly is gone. And that's how it is on talk and television, folks. People that showed up, you know, late tonight, missed out on that opening music, and they're going to rue the day.
Oh, I do rue the day.
We've got some...
You're not going to give it a rest.
The station was on me about not having Christmas music. So during this break, we've got some special Christmas music, and then we're going to come back. I've got questions from listeners here of email. Guess what they want to talk about? High Chaparral. And we're going to get the facts from Susan when we continue to talk television on Retro Radio.
It's Christmas time and I'm in trouble. Got too drunk at the company affair. Sat on the copier, wore no apparel. Did it on a dare. Insulted the boss and French kissed a stranger. Pinched his butt, poured beer on his toupee. Till someone said, you don't know the danger. The boss's friend is gay. More beer for you and for me. And stories for us to share. No fear, I jumped on a desk and danced while everyone stared. I didn't even know I put on the show. Till next morning, take a look at that. It's facts to one and all. Merry Christmas to one and all.
It's Christmas time at the office party. We'll get drunk and do annoying things.
I grabbed the boss's wife by the ass and had myself a fling.
We'll goose a friend and tell the manager, piss him off and send him on his way. Have a toast to laugh at his anger, he slips on the way.
You're fired!
Beer for you and for me and stories for us to share.
No fear, I'm happy to table dance on cubicle square.
She didn't even know she put on a show until next morning. Take a look at that, it's posted on the internet. Merry Christmas to one and all.
Yeah. You're fired!
Oh, and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, I think we finally found a theme Tim can identify. What was that one, Timmy?
The Odd Couple.
Oh, yes, so simple. Another program that you worked on, right,
yes,
Susan?
Yes.
Okay, I've got
And who wrote that?
That one I don't have.
Oh.
Well, you can tell us.
That was written by Neil Hefti.
Yeah, see?
I didn't want to show you up.
We've got a, let me see how I want to take this. We've got a caller on the line, but let me take an email question first. This one is from Connor. Connor says, at what time did your father get interested in music, and what, if any, advice for youngsters do you have? And I'm going to, you know, I guess don't buy Enron or something, but that's not the kind of advice that he wants in music. So what can you say to Connor?
Well, Connor, thank you for that question. I think the best idea for a young person who wants to be in music is to start very early, as early on as they can, and to practice as much as possible. You're never you can never say, I'm great, I don't have to practice again. My father, when he was even a concert pianist, still studied and worked hard and practiced very hard. You never can know and do everything. You're always kind of like a sponge. You take in everything and learn things all the time. And that's what I think that would be the best suggestion I can say for Connor.
Yeah, well, I you know, can certainly agree with that. Not that he needs my expertise, but I'll tell you, if you look at people in any profession, and for myself, a couple months back, I was at a doctor's office, and here is a man with the walls are lined with diplomas, multiple PhDs, and I ask him, you know, what he's doing, and he's still going to school.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always new things happening.
Exactly what he said. So I'll tell you, the people that are really geniuses and are really brilliant realize that you're never going to know everything.
That's right. So, Connor, keep studying.
All right. Let's take the caller. This is David from Welch, West Virginia. David, I missed you last week since the phones were down. Glad you're back.
Yeah, David, I tried to call last week, but I couldn't get through. I wonder why.
Well, that was a problem with the phone system. Nothing to do with you. That was, you know, when the systems are so, they're all software-driven. And so it's just like the computer crashes and you got to reboot things. And that was at the KSAV studio. So I'm sorry that worked out. We were not sabotaging you. What are your comments here for tonight?
David, my question for your guest tonight, Susan, has casting for television changed from when you were casting for shows like Little House on the Prairie and so forth? I mean, today, mostly the director of the show or the director of the movie has the final say on his cast. Back when you were a casting director, did you have the final say, or did someone higher than you have the final say?
I'll tell you, a director and a producer always have the final say. It did way back when I cast, which wasn't that long ago because I'm still casting. Actually, a casting director's job is to bring in the very best possible candidates for each part. And usually, when you do that, you give the best best people to your director to hear what they can do and to possibly bring tape and show things. Things really haven't changed that much. What's changed that much is the quality of the shows and what you're looking for. You know, things are not like Little House anymore. Things are, you know, we're not looking for so many period piece type of things, that a lot of children, a lot of things like that. But even so, things are pretty much the same. The last person who gets a say-so is either a director or producer. Of course, that was my experience. Most other casting directors do have to go through the network. The network casting departments usually have the final say-so. In my situation working with Michael Landon, Michael really had the last word. And the networks really looked up to him and his talents and would let him go ahead with whatever he felt was the right thing. And obviously, with his track record and the quality of shows that we did, they were right in doing so.
All right. So the things really haven't changed that much.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
All right. David, anything else?
Yeah. Since she brought it up.
Go right ahead.
Uh-oh.
I asked your husband this a few weeks ago. He said he didn't have anything to do with the production of ABC's miniseries Little House. Did you have anything to do with picking the candidates for the cast?
Absolutely not.
Okay, on what? On which show was that?
This was the new Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, the new one.
Back.
New one, okay.
Yeah, it
did
no.
You like that show, David?
It wasn't exactly what I expected. I stopped watching it after the second part of the series.
Okay. And,
I was just
and
wondering,
so,
did
so I guess, you know, the different talents or the different people...
from the original production team have anything else to do with it.
Okay, and I guess it showed then.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, David, it's good to hear from you again. I'm glad you persevered after last week's little technical glitch, and I always appreciate you listening and calling.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
All right, thank you very much.
Good night, Dave.
Okay, now look, I'm going to get this in so that I don't get myself in trouble. We are the greatest show on television, High Chaparral.
Yes.
I've got three or four emails. This one is from Tanya. Tanya is in Holland, I believe, too, because I got an email from her and said she loves the show. I'm going to read that next week.
That's out of the country, Dave.
She mentioned she has to get up at 5 a.m. to listen to my show.
That's wonderful.
I wouldn't get up at 5 a.m. to listen to me. So this is you know, anyway, she said, dear Dave, could you ask Mrs. McCrae if she was actively involved in casting The High Chaparral? She has another question, assuming this answer is yes. So answer that one first.
I did not cast The High Chaparral. I worked on the show as a casting secretary back then.
Oh, dear. Now we're down to... Now, I know earlier on you were what you termed an associate director.
That's correct.
Okay. What's the difference between an associate director, a casting director, and a casting secretary?
All right. When I started in the business, in casting, I started as a secretary, which meant, or means, that anything that the casting director needs, typing up cast lists of who we've hired, getting actors over to wardrobe, making work calls, getting them to location,
okay.
of that kind of thing.
Okay, all right. So you weren't active in the in selecting the people.
I was not active, no. But
okay.
It was very fortunate I did that because I really met all of the wonderful agents and a lot of talent in that position.
Okay, well, I won't go on with the second part of her question because it has to do with, you know, if you had been, she had a question. But Tanya, thank you for sending that in. Now I want to get this in because so far at least two or three people before the program. This is from Bill in San Francisco. He emailed me,
mm-hmm.
Dear Mr. White. You hear that, Tim? Mr. White.
That.
Yeah,
Mr.
heavy
White.
On the Mister. I want you to get that down. Several weeks ago, I heard your guest Kent McCrae answer a question about Mark Slade. And incidentally, the Mark Slade issue here appears to be a greater mystery than who Jack the Ripper was,
really?
From what I can tell on here. Answer a question about Mark Slade being fired from the High Chaparral. He said that it wasn't true that Mr. Slade was there the whole time, and he also said that you should ask his wife about this.
Mm-hmm.
As a fan of the series, this is Bill, says, I distinctly recall Mr. Slade being absent from the fourth season. Could you please clear this up? Now, hold on before you get to that, because I also had Ginny send a question. And she, oh, no, I'm sorry, this was, Ginny had one here. Oh, here it is, yes. Ginny says, when Kent was on Talking Television, he was asked about Mark Slade's departure from Season 4 of High Chaparral. Part of his response was, quote, you'd have to ask my wife. Kent's, you know, I knew you were going to love this. Kent's final answer, now he sounds like Regis Philbin. Kent's final answer was that Mark was still involved in the show, yet he never appeared in any of the shows in Season 4.
No.
Now, hold on. We're not done yet. This is complicated stuff. Now, besides that, I didn't want to. I said, how can these people, you know, hear a program 5 or 6 weeks ago, and then come and know exactly what was said? So I went back and I researched this,
mm-hmm.
and I read the question concerning Mark Slade and
mm-hmm.
Season 4, and here is what Kent said: broadcast engineer, could we have track number 6, please? So what can you tell us about Mark Slade and his departure from the program?
Well, I don't think he ever departed from the program, and my wife may know more about that than I do. At one point, he was demanding more money, which, like a lot of stars do, and NBC refused, and he said he wasn't going to show up for work. At the last minute, he did, and I think he was there for the entire 4 years. I don't think he ever left the show. We brought in a couple of other people during the source of the show, and maybe his part was eliminated in some shows, but I believe he was there the entire 4 years.
All right, that was from the October 25th edition of Talking Television with Dave White. That was Kent McRae, Susan's husband, and you heard him dump it all on you, Susan. No, he didn't really. But now, since the world wants to know, what can you tell us about Mark Slade and season 4 of High Chaparral?
First of all, my husband is correct. Mr. Slade, Mark, who had the most gorgeous blue eyes and still does, was in all of through the whole series that it was on. And as he said, as my husband said, he may not have been in all the episodes or in a lot of the episodes, but he was there. And as all of the Chaparral fans will remember, we brought in a character called Wind, played by Rudy Ramos. And when Wind was brought into the show, there was a lot of things given to him to do, which possibly could have been given to Mark at some point. He was an Indian of the tribe, but as far as I know, and believe me, I was there.
Okay. I'm convinced.
Mark was there. He was in the show. Whether he was written in there for a few episodes, whether he wasn't, that's another story, but he was there.
Okay, there you have it, folks. They're sticking together like glue. No, listen, sometimes, folks, you got to accept the answer. If that's the way it is, that's the way it is. I've got a question. This is from Fred. Oh, he must be a bit of a Western fan. He says, howdy.
Howdy.
Howdy. He says, your father spent a lot of time, at least this is his statement, on High Chaparral. What, if any, was his favorite time or part to work on? Did your father work on that?
My father wrote the music for High Chaparral.
Okay, so we talked about that.
Yes, we did.
A little earlier.
Remember the High Chaparral suite?
That was over 15 minutes ago.
Oh,
you know, I can't
I'm
remember
sorry.
From
your turn. Take your medicine.
By, you know, you and Kent are supposed to remember things that happened, you know,
I'm
50
sorry.
Years ago.
Then
you, you know, well, I mean, let's see. We've got Tim. Did you have a question you wanted to ask Susan?
No, I'm still trying to see you recover from the High Chaparral faux pas.
Well, wait a minute. Fred had a question. What was?
Yeah,
it?
What was the question that Fred had?
Well, let's see. No, it had to do with your father's part in High Chaparral, and we talked about it, the music.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That was the question.
He loved High Chaparral, by the way, my father.
Was he on the set much? That would be a good one for Fred. Was he? I know he did the music, but did he come on the set much? Or?
He would come down there once in a while, but not often. I know that a lot of the actors used to leave the set and go to the scoring stage to see him because they loved the fact that my father wrote themes for their characters, and so they would love to hear it.
Did he watch like the outtakes, or I mean, how did he do that for the characters? If they brought in a new character, like the one you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
did he sit back and read the script? Did he watch them act? How did he score it?
Well, the usual routine was that he would receive a script first. He would go in, and if that wasn't possible, he would go in and they would run a show for him, without music. He would look at the show and make notes with the music editor, and they would do cue sheets. Now, cue sheets consisted of how long a scene was, who was in it, to kind of refresh his memory about the specific scene, where music should go in the show. And so he would watch that and then go home And they would send the cue sheets to him all typed up, which was one of my first jobs, as a matter of fact, typing his cue sheets. And he would start writing for the show. And he would, if there was a new character, it would be written there. And he would have seen that by then. And nowadays, of course, which is great, they send home either a DVD or a VHS of the show so that the composer doesn't have to come in and watch it in a screening room at the studio any longer.
All right, I want to take our next time out, and then when we come back, I've got a couple of more questions, one from Tim,
mm-hmm.
and we also want to have a chance to kind of talk about some of these other shows like Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days, and generic questions about casting a show too, because I want the inside stuff. I might want to go down and audition. What do we got coming up here? Carling beer and Lucky Strike cigarettes for Christmas, just in time for the holidays. Stick around. We'll be back real quick with Susan McCrae, Tim Carmody, and myself talking television on Sherevision Radio.
Happy holidays, happy holidays from Carling Black Label, Carling Black Label. Label, Black Label, Carling Black Label beer.
Buy it by the case for the holidays.
Friends, here's a wonderful Christmas gift for anyone who smokes, because it says Merry Christmas and Happy Smoking 200 times. Yes, 10 packs of those better-tasting Luckies. All done up for Christmas in a beautiful carton created just for Lucky Strike by the famous designer, Mr. Raymond Loy. It'll look so bright and colorful under your Christmas tree, and it's such a welcome gift to anyone who enjoys a good smoke. Because, you know, smoking enjoyment is all a matter of taste. And the fact of the matter is, Lucky's taste better. Cleaner, fresher, smoother. That's why you can't go wrong if you remember your friends with these colorful Christmas cartons of Lucky Strike.
Do, do, do. Be happy, go lucky for Christmas gifts this year.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,
give us any chance, we'll take it. With any rule, we'll break it.
All right, another brain buster, Timmy. What theme is this?
Well, Lenny and Squiggy out.
Oh, you know, those are my favorites. If you want to join in the discussion, 800-407-KSAV. Email address is talk@ksav.org, and we've got a couple of emails I'm gonna be reading. You know, you talk about music. I was doing a research here for some shows, a 77 Sunset Strip. Mm-hmm. I got the lyrics here for a song called Kooky Lend Me Your Comb.
A big hit.
Now you're on the way, miss, and I'm reading you just fine. Don't cut out of here till we get on cloud nine. I've got smog in my noggin ever since you made the scene. Wouldn't your father have been proud to have put that together?
No question.
Yeah, okay. You know, you mentioned the when we were on the phone the other day, you weren't duly impressed with the Bonanza lyrics.
Well, no.
Okay.
I mean, I think we got a right to pick a little fight. A little
Yes, I really, you know, Tim, we were on there. I said, oh, I thought those were pretty good. That was the response I got.
You know, Mike Landon used to sing that down the hall just to get everybody laughing. So.
What was the story you wanted to tell? Was it about Laverne and Shirley?
Oh, Laverne and Shirley, yes, you played the theme. I think
you worked on that show as well.
Yes, I remember one morning I got a phone call from Gary Marshall, who was the...
That was Penny Marshall's husband?
No, Penny Marshall's brother.
Brother, okay.
And Tony Marshall was the was their father. And Tony was executive producer, and Gary was a producer-director. And he called one morning, and he said, you know, I won't do an imitation of him, but he had a very strong New York accent. And he said, you know, he said, I need you to find this particular part, and if you can bring in five women. And I said, okay. He said, I'm looking for a woman. We're doing this talent contest. I'm looking for a woman who can play the accordion, preferably Lady of Spain, and play the cymbals with her knees at the same time.
Common request.
And I said, really?
And he wanted five.
He wanted five.
Yeah.
He wanted a selection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being a musician's daughter, I said, okay, now there's only one way I can possibly find someone like this, and that's to call the Musicians Union. So I called up there, and of course, it was got a big laugh, I got to tell you. But
so.
You know, I found five women, and I called up Gary, and I said, I've got your five women, and he said, you got five? And I said, yeah, I got five. And I sent them upstairs, and he interviewed them, and he called downstairs. He said, boy, this was tough. He said, I finally picked one, and we hired her, and she did the show. And about 2 weeks later, she called in. Gary called me. He said, you won't believe it. She's filed a grievance with the Guild, which means she's in essence wants to sue us for money. And I said, what for? He said, well, it seems as though she's upset because her knees got black and blue when she was playing the cymbals while she was doing Lady of Spain.
Oh,
and so I guess she wasn't experienced by as a knee cymbalist.
Well, I guess that was the problem. But it was quite an experience, I'll tell you.
I guess in the polka halls they don't bang the cymbals.
That's right.
Kirsten,
mm-hmm.
Wants to know, what do you feel was one of your best or most successful casting decisions?
Wow, that's a good question.
See, if I asked Tim what was the best decision he ever made in his life, he wouldn't have to think about it. There's probably only been one.
I'm thinking. Actually, boy, there are several.
Well, just give an example.
I think one of the best ideas that came was hiring Jason Bateman to play on Little House, and you all know what's happened to his career. And Shannon Doherty was a good decision. She was a wonderful child actress.
Wow, even before she became kind of mean?
Well, but you don't know that, Tim.
I know.
You think it was just the publicity stuff with her?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that's all right. So those would be
and
two.
I think, these are tough because we've been very fortunate to find some wonderful people, unknown people to play big roles.
Did you cast Melissa Gilbert?
I did not. She was cast before I started Little House.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then you missed out. That was from William. And he assumed that you did, so you could have covered yourself with glory. He said, when you cast Melissa Gilbert,
did you just
know that she was the one? So that was someone...
Well, I'll tell you, she was the best child actress I've ever seen. She started, I think, at 8 years old with us. She was just wonderful.
Okay. I was going to... Well, you've explained some of it. Like, what is a casting director? What are the responsibilities?
Well, the responsibility is to find someone who's perfect for a role in a script that you get. And, you know, for a casting director, when you read, it's like when you read a book and you envision in your head how you see a character, you know? And you can either cast what we call on the nose, which is exactly the description in a script, or you can cast what we call offbeat, which is totally different from what the script says, but it works.
Would people, for example, somebody comes up with an idea, a creator, I guess, of the show,
mm-hmm.
Would they come with just no idea of who they wanted, say, to star in the show, and you would cast for, like, the leads in these shows, or do they come to you with...
kind of the big name or the stars picked out, and then you're supposed to fill in from there. How does...
Well, sometimes what happens is a network will come to a casting director and say, look, we have a deal. We have a series deal with so-and-so, and we're going to cast that person in this lead role, and we have to cast the rest of the show. That happens sometimes, a lot of times. Or you have a new project, and you absolutely are looking for someone to play the lead, and you search out for someone like that. You know, it can happen either way.
How is it done? Now, you use the term, excuse me, search out. Do you, if you're, you know, casting a program, do you audition? Are you just, is this, do you go by, like, you have files of people that you might sort through?
Well, there's always going to theater, lots of theater, seeing people who are known as well as totally unknown, and you can see incredible talent that way. Go to small theater. I'm not talking about the big major theaters in town, but small theaters have a lot of wonderful talent. There are agents in town who will read that you're looking for something. We call it a breakdown. Casting directors give out a breakdown to the agents of what they're looking for, and they submit their clients that they feel would be right for a part you're looking for. Then once you see the submissions, you bring in and have general interviews. In other words, you interview as many of those submissions as you can and break down which ones are most right, and then you bring them back for another interview, and they read with me, and then I break it down again, and I bring them back for the director, and I read with them for the director. And it just depends how many times you call back someone to make certain that you have the right person. If they have past experience and they have film on themselves, you run the film and you take a look at what they've done in the past. You look at their resumes and see what they've done. You see what their training is. You see the small plays even in school that they've done. And, you know, it's not as complicated as you think, but it's thorough.
So, is it highly competitive? Are there lots of people?
Extremely competitive.
Okay, looking for the.
Do you find people chasing you down in restaurants, or agents always trying to get close to you?
I don't think I've ever gone into a restaurant where I haven't met a waiter who isn't an actor.
That's true.
But do they know who you are?
Sometimes.
Okay. But do, for example, you say you go in the restaurant, how do they bring it about that they're actors? I mean, do they tell just everybody who comes in that
they start singing?
No.
No, actually, you know, there are certain restaurants, either here or in New York, where actors are prevalent as waiters or working, you know, in the restaurant themselves. And they know, they really know who the casting people or agents are. Otherwise, what they do is come over and just kind of chit-chat a little bit, and you talk somehow, one way or the other. Either I'll say, boy, you'd make a great actor, and he'll say, yeah, I am one. Or,
has anyone ever approached you, or is it common for somebody to offer a kickback or a bribe?
No, I've never received one.
Well, I wasn't expecting you to fess up and give a phone number to call you. You wouldn't be a good bribe taker here if you do it. No, but let's, putting your personal experience aside, is that something that, say, some agents or some people try to do?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think it's that kind of a... as far as getting a client into a casting office for an agent, I don't think there's too much that can be done to, as far as bribing. I mean, if you go into the music business, however, to get your record played on the air, there's an awful lot of that going on.
Well, it's still?
I think so.
Okay. All right. But
you still got a chance to get your record on.
Yeah, records. You know, I'm one of the few guys I know that have records. I got a record player. You
So
oh, hey, I was going to, yeah, doesn't everybody? I was going to tell you, Susan, I was watching a show on a DVD I got last night, and it was from about 1959 or 1960, and it was Philip Marlowe.
Oh,
and
yes.
And it was starred, I think, Philip Carey.
Yes.
Played the part. And at the end of that, because I always pay attention, I was watching the credits, and Kent McRae was an associate producer on
that's
that.
That's correct.
Yeah, so well, you keep alert. Did you know Philip Carey, or do you know who I
met? I know Phil Carey. Phil Carey, as a matter of fact, did a Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, okay. I didn't really. You know what? I'm unfamiliar with him. He's obviously a big guy, based
well,
on what I saw.
He is a regular on a series, a soap opera called One Life to Live on ABC.
Oh, okay. So is still going on. I was going to ask, and obviously this is well, you know, I'm not going to embarrass myself by asking.
Oh,
no, I'm not. I'm going to do it off the air now that he's still around.
Oh,
it was just my typical ignorance. You had, I want to get this in here because it was a good story. You met maybe more than once Jack Lord, didn't you? You worked on the program Hawaii Five-0.
Yes, I did.
All right. What was your position at Hawaii Five-0?
I was the casting director.
It was associate because
No, I was full-fledged.
Full-fledged. Okay, because you corrected me, you know, that I was you know, giving you false pretenses
well,
promoting you on the show.
I'll tell you, I didn't want to take credit for something that I didn't do.
No,
so
I know,
so
and that
I
was
wanted
my
to
mistake.
Make certain that was clear. But on Hawaii Five-0, I cast the show for a couple of years.
Now, did you cast the leads like Jack Lord, MacArthur?
No, that was before me.
Did you cast any of them like Zulu and Kono and
all the guest actors that came from quote the mainland
right.
came from me
and went to the Rock
yeah
because I know how they did that. I always wondered why you had a guy on there whose name in the program was Kono, but his name was Zulu. Why couldn't he just be Zulu on the show? I guess. anyway, tell the story.
You know Henry Darrow guest starred on Hawaii Five-0 several times, and Henry Darrow was a regular on High Chaparral.
Oh, yes. I
just wanted you to know that for your fans.
I know, and believe me, I'm sure that I'm glad you did, because they would have been on me again. Tell the story, though, about Jack Lord came, I guess, too, because you didn't work in Hawaii, did you?
No, I worked out here
at
CBS.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell the story you told me about when Jack came down.
Well, it was interesting. Jack came into town to meet me when I first started working there, and he walked into the office. We weren't obviously shooting here in town. He shot everything in Hawaii, and when he walked in, he was in full makeup, and his you know that they always had that he always had that curl on his forehead.
I thought it grew that way.
Yeah, well, it's possible. But he walked in, and I just was really in shock. I couldn't believe, but I guess he felt more comfortable walking in full makeup.
Yeah, you told me you thought, oh, I guess they're doing some shooting here locally
because
Jack's, you know, in the so there was nothing vain about Jack Lord.
Oh, I don't think so. The first day we would start shooting, the people here on the mainland used to receive a tape of the first day of shooting in Hawaii, and because we all had to share in the what was known as the Lord's Prayer before we started shooting. So, you know.
All right. I've got about two things. I want to see how they fit in the break. Let me ask you this. Poor casting. If some people don't think that casting is important, a poorly cast program or a poor cast for a program can ruin what would otherwise be a good program. Isn't that correct?
It'd be very painful.
What about hurting an actor's career?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no one word answers now. If and here's something where I guess upcoming actors, aspiring actors, are anxious to get the parts. Naturally, you want to work,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes
if they get in the wrong part, aren't they hurting themselves more than helping themselves?
Well, it depends on, you know, an actor has the right to take a part or not. But I remember very distinctly years ago, Ricardo Montalban said to me, I will never turn down any role because I will be sorry later if I do. I always take everything because you never know where it's going to lead you. I don't think there's anything that can ruin your career unless you do some kind of pornographic film or something.
Well, okay.
But other than that, I don't think it's bad. It's all an experience.
Okay.
Every part can be an experience one way or the other.
I, as a couple of examples I'll just name, and these didn't ruin anybody's career, whatever, but frequently I'll see programs or movies, and it'll be in my mind that person wasn't very good, not because they weren't a good actor, didn't do a good job, it's because, in my opinion, they were not properly cast for that part. An example is I always liked William Conrad,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't think William Conrad was well cast in canon. It was, I mean, to see him, the biggest struggle you saw in canon was him getting in and out of that Lincoln. And for him to, you know, hustle down the street and do a six-block chase and bring somebody down or whatever, I just think didn't fit the role of that he was cast in as a detective. And another one was in the second Dragnet series, Harry Morgan was an excellent actor, but it was a little tough to see little Harry Morgan run up and bring down somebody who looks like he was part-time, was a linebacker for the Rams or whatever, and slap the cuffs on him. I just thought he was a little miscast for that particular part.
Well, you're being a critic, and that's what audiences are. And if everyone has different opinions about different people that they see in roles, and they have the right to. Obviously, for the most part, the network was happy with these people in those roles, and for the most part, audiences kept watching it, and it stayed on the air for quite some time.
Well, I'll guarantee you, I watched them. I like canon,
mm-hmm.
and I watched it, and I darn sure watched Dragnet.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you're right. I can make the, oh, I like that. I'm a critic. I think I'll start writing a newspaper column.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a time out. One more quick little Christmas song, and then we'll come back, and Susan and I and Mr. Carmody, Guru Carmody, will wrap things up on Sharevision Radio.
Excuse me, can we talk just you and I for a moment, please? Now, I don't mean to come across as rude, but this has been bothering me all year. I just have to. Now, I notice there's lots of presents underneath the tree, but you can stick them up your chimney. I want money.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
Cash is all I want.
That's what I want, huh? Huh, 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 huh. That's the bottom line. If you really want to give me a thrill, just leave those envelopes with a $100 bill. You remember the envelopes, those little ones your grandmother used, or the circle cut out so the dead president's face was right there on the card? That's what I want, huh? Huh, 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 huh. Now you can skip the little envelope if it's too much trouble. If you really love the King of Jews, and I trust you on that, fork it over. Don't be a Scrooge. I want money.
That's what I want.
That's really all I want. I mean, I've made it as plain as I possibly can. I mean, the baby Jesus needed money. That's the first thing they brought him. Three wise men, they came across the desert, they brought him gold. Let's cut to the chase here. If I don't have it, I don't want it. If I didn't already buy it for myself, then there's a reason. I mean, let's look at what you've got there. I'm not going to wear that. I'm not going to ever put that in my closet. I'm going to throw it away. Sing it to her, boys. I mean, they get it. Why can't you get it? Ladies and gentlemen, the surviving Beatles. Ladies and gentlemen. Fabulous, boy. Wonderful. Aren't they incredible? Well, really, it was what I'm paying you.
That's what I want. That's what I want.
again, everybody. Look at me, I'm the fifth Beatle. Oh, happy holidays, really. And don't spill anything on the carpet, Bongo. Bongo, Ringo, whatever, whatever.
I won't even waste my time asking you for that one. Okay, now just selected the 5-0 theme because that was another program that Susan did. Susan, what was the most difficult show that you ever cast?
I think probably there was a movie of the week called The Five of Me. It was about a gentleman who had five different personalities, and it was a true story. And it was very difficult to select the lead for that, who happened to do an incredible job. David Burney was the star of that.
What about as like a show, not just casting one part for a show? Mm-hmm. Was there any particular show that just by its very nature was difficult to do?
No.
Well, like lots of guests, different people to cast on a weekly basis, for example.
So we used to bring in a lot of guest actors for our shows, and we had a lot of children. I think it was the mothers of the children that were the most difficult to deal with, rather than casting the kids. But I was known when we were doing Little House on the Prairie and Father Murphy at the same time, and I was doing a KCET children's show at the same time. I was known as I cast more children than you could imagine in a year's time. And so you have to find a good kid. That's tough.
Tim, you had a question for Susan. Go ahead.
So, you know, sometimes we hear stories about, like, Fez in that show, the 70s show, where he came up with his own phony accent to do an interview with a casting agent. Did anybody really strike you as really unique and original and trying to get a part, somebody that really struck your fancy that came into audition?
Well, the only thing that comes to mind at the moment is we had a wonderful actress, who's still a wonderful actress, Pamela Roylance, who came in for an interview for a regular role on Little House on the Prairie. And I thought she had a wonderful look for the show, a very, what we call a period look. And I read her. She was terrific. But I said, you know, I got to tell you, if you're on camera, you're going to photograph 20 pounds heavier, at least. And I said, you're going to have to do something to take off that, you know, because she had a wonderful baby face. And the next week she came back to read for Mike Landon for the regular part. And she came back, and my gosh, she looked skinny. And I, you know, she had this cinch belt on, and I thought, holy smoke. I said, Pam, you look wonderful. How did you do this? She said, I quit my job. I said, you quit your job? I said, I didn't mean for you to quit your job. I just wanted you to kind of watch your weight. And she said, no, I had to quit my job. I said, why? She said, because I worked in a chocolate factory. Well, your laughter gives you an idea of what we did, Michael and I, when she said that.
Oh, that's terrific.
You know, that was the most unusual situation that ever happened as far as casting someone. And
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, the true stories are always the funniest. I want to remind everybody to stick around at 9 o'clock Pacific time, right after this show, Sidewalks of San Francisco. And this is Timmy's show, news and commentary culled from the pages of the San Francisco Chronicle, which means a lot of it might be fiction.
Oh, true. It's in the news.
We get together at Clancy's Cafe. I hear the theme music. That means things are over. Susan, thanks a lot for coming on. This was really fun. I hope it was fun for you.
I had a great time.
And I'm glad that we have at last put the Mark Slade controversy to bed. I look forward to your program here on January, so I invite everybody to kind of stay tuned for details on that.
I do, too.
Tim, I look forward to it, too. Maybe you'll be my guest.
Hey, we talked about that. Tim, thanks a lot for coming on and suffering the abuse one more time.
Swings and arrows, okay.
Okay, and I'll see you next week, the Rockford Files next week. You be here as well. This is Sheriff Vision Radio.
It's like a light of a new day. It came from out of the blue, breaking me out of the spell I was in, making all of my wishes come true. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free, flying away on a wing and a prayer. Who?